This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome to Healing with Dr. Daniels. It is Sunday, April 1st, 2018, April Fool's Day, and no, today's broadcast is not a joke. It is absolutely serious. I know some things are tough to believe, but you know what? You cannot make this stuff up. I'd also like to say, Happy Easter to those of you celebrating Easter. Today, for me, is going to be a day of rest. I am so excited. All right. So, today's topic is opioids, and I'm giving you an update. And am I giving you an update because the problem is solved? I'm giving you an update because I want you to have an insight into how the medical industrial complex works, how it approaches problem solving, so that you can have an understanding of the model that's used to approach your medical problems, whether it's hypertension or diabetes or arthritis or any number of afflictions. But this is how it goes. And I have seen this so many times that it's actually a pattern. And so I'm going to share with you the pattern and the insight. So just to kind of update you, there's something called opioids, and opioids are compounds that deaden the brain's perception of pain. They don't do anything to help the pain. No. Deaden the brain's perception of pain. And these compounds also cause severe constipation, depressed respiration, and in the extreme cases can even cause death. And those cases are actually becoming more and more frequent. This is 2018, and about 2016, the last point at which they have statistics, around 50,000 Americans died of this situation. Now, the shocking thing is many of these opioids that are killing people are actually prescription opioids that they are receiving from their doctors. And then, on top of that, they'll mix other opioids, for example, like heroin. And lately, the heroin has been laced with something called fentanyl. Fentanyl is a narcotic that's many times more powerful than actual heroin. And a very, very, very small part of piece of fentanyl, like basically less than a milligram, can kill people. And so this has become a problem. Also, narcotics, the fentanyl plus heroin, is now being snorted as opposed to exclusively used IV. And that makes it much more accessible. But the point is, people are dying, and they're dying from the use of drugs approved by the FDA, and it's becoming very obvious. And so there's a move akin to the war on poverty and the war on cancer and so many other wars that we've endured to somehow stem this epidemic. So the medical industrial complex has not been idle. They have been looking for solutions. And I'm telling you, when I saw this one, I fell out of my chair. Tamper-resistant opioids. So the medical industrial complex came up with a bright idea of making narcotics tamper-resistant. Yes. So those of you who are familiar with tamper-resistant packaging know that it's difficult to open, but a determined drug addict, could easily overcome it. So let's take a look at the tamper-resistant opioid project, how it's turned out, and see if it can give us insights into the problem-solving process of the medical industrial complex. So we're going to spend the first hour going over these solutions and events in the war on opioids. And I'll point out the patterns for you, because the patterns probably be difficult for you to see because you haven't seen the other patterns. So I'll point out the part that are patterns that we see in the medical industrial complex's approach to, for example, heart disease. And it's totally parallels, by the way, the cholesterol situation. All right. And this is Australia, but it still applies because, again, it's the same medical industrial complex, the same drugs, the same problem, and the same intellectual approach. All right. So this is from the Medscape Family Medicine, the international authority in the latest in advances in medicine. And this is January 18th. So the introduction of tamper-resistant opioid tablets in Australia has led to less tampering with the tablets. Okay, that's very good. But it has not had any significant impact on rates of opioid use or harms at a population level, new research shows. The opioid problem is complex. Yes. And tamper-resistant formulations are one part of a multi-pronged approach that is needed, incorporating both regulatory and clinical responses. Now, I just want to say, somebody made a lot of money providing this tamper-resistant apparatus. And these study was done by the National Drug and Alcohol Research Center, University of South Wales, Sydney, Australia. Okay, so we have authority here weighing in. No single solution. A tamper-resistant formulation of controlled-release oxycodone rapidly replaced the non-tamper-resistant formulation after it was introduced in Australia, April 2014. As part of the National Opioid Medication Abuse Deterrent Study, read NOMAD, the acronym, a physician and colleagues analyzed data from multiple sources, including opioid sales data, multiple health database data sets, annual surveys of people who inject drugs, and a cohort of 606 people who reported tampering with opioids before and after introduction of tamper-resistant oxycodone. All right. So, just for your information, some addicts will open the pill, dump out the powder contents, and then use that and either administer it snorting or through their veins. Okay, just in case you're not familiar with this. So to our knowledge, our study is the most systematic and comprehensive examination of the effect of a new opioid formulation to date, studying the impact of a tamper-resistant formulation of controlled-release oxycodone on population-level opioid use and opioid-related harm, which is overdose, help-seeking, that means maybe going to the emergency room, and treatment-seeking, and opioid use, tampering, and attractiveness of tampering among populations likely to tamper with pharmaceutical opioids, the researchers write. So the investigators found that injection drug users were less likely to tamper with the crush-resistant pills and did not appear to switch to other opioids, like heroin. Now, the other thing to understand is maybe they didn't tamper with the crush-resistant pills, but maybe they switched to other pills that were not crush-resistant. But at a population level, tamper-resistant oxycodone has had no effect on the rates of opioid use, the investigators found. Opioid use continued to increase at a similar rate before and after the introduction of tamper-resistant oxycodone. Wait a minute. Well, first of all, introducing tamper resistance to a product designed for the adult population is absurd, right? So a child has dexterity issues, emotional, mental maturity issues, and is not likely to figure out a workaround for the tamper-resistant packaging. The other thing about a tamper-resistant packaging in an adult population is, by definition, you have to make it so the product is usable by a competent adult. So to say that you make tamper-resistant packaging for an adult population is like nonsense, because the packaging has to be accessible and usable by adults. Okay. So we've got here at least a false premise. All right. As population-wide strategy to reduce harm of overuse or overprescription of opioids, The introduction of tamper-resistant formulations alone will not be enough to affect these outcomes. But wait. Overuse means you took too many pills. The tamper-resistant packaging, we will soon see, has in no way limits the number of pills you can take. And overprescription means a doctor wrote too many prescriptions for opioids. The tamper-resistant packaging does not affect, influence, mitigate, or reduce the number of prescriptions that doctors write. So we have a problem. They've identified people use too many and doctors prescribe too many. They've introduced a solution, tamper resistance, that has nothing to do with either one of these problems. You got that? Right. So this is the way the medical industrial complex approaches each and every illness or condition. You pick an aspect of it that is visible. You give it an emotionally appealing name like tamper resistance. You roll it out. You're doing something. And of course, it has no influence, right? It has no impact, no results, because what you're addressing, the tamper resistance, has nothing to do with the problem, which is doctors write too many prescriptions and patients take too many of them. All right. This is very important. So we have the cholesterol issue, by the way, with heart disease, where they've now established without a doubt that cholesterol levels have nothing to do with heart disease. And the degree to which you lower the cholesterol does not improve all-cause mortality outcome. All right? So we have the same thing going on. This is, you know, parallel. And so we need to enhance approaches to pain management and comorbidity, including improving access to non-medication approaches, said Dr. Lorenz. Now, introducing a non-medication or non-drug approach to pain has nothing to do with tamper resistance. So this is important. You introduce a solution that involves revenue, profit, selling somebody something, but has no impact on the problem or its genesis. Now, with things like heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, whatever, arthritis, the medical industrial complex is quick to say there is no cause and there is no cure. So if there's no cause, then that kind of relieves you of the responsibility of addressing causative factors. It gives you license, permission to be irrelevant and to introduce irrelevant approaches to the problem. So no one can call you on it and say, hey, wait, you're not addressing the cause. You can say, well, there is no cause. Okay. So for people already experiencing problematic opioid use, so for people who are already taking too many pills, improving the accessibility and attractiveness of treatments for opioid use disorders is essential, as are measures to reduce opioid-related harm, such as scaling up take-home naloxone programs, she adds. Now, naloxone, just by the way, is also deadly, just saying. So reconsider assumptions. So somebody's got the boldness of saying, we've made a false assumption here. We have assumed that the ability to tamper with the pills is related to the deadliness of the drug. And that was a false assumption. So in a lengthy research at the Injury Prevention Center of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, bringing it home to the United States, notes that drug use has been long recognized to be an interaction between the drug, individual influences, and social context. And so this study leads us to consider whether abuse deterrence is an inherent property of the drug itself or its intended effect lies in an interaction with social context. Now, this is a lot of gobbledygook confusion, but what they're saying is, oops, tamper resistance may be irrelevant. So in this study, population-level changes in overdose rates were not statistically significant. So in other words, in their study, when they looked at the effect of this tamper resistance, there was no change in overdose rates. And if we incorrectly believe that a single product caused the opioid crisis, we are likely to be skeptical if that product's replacement does not result in gross change. Perhaps we must reconsider our assumptions. No kidding. No kidding. So again, this is doublespeak. And don't worry if you're confused, because it's confusing. It's designed to confuse. The bottom line here, which is the only thing that counts, is perhaps we must reconsider our assumptions. Perhaps, of course. And so we talk about funding of the study. Who provided funding for the study? Educational grants from Rickett, Bexar, individuals for studies. Okay. All right. So, again, this is a classical approach to the problem, which is pick something that has no impact on the outcome, market it, sell it, have everyone implement it, and if the ultimate thing doesn't change, I mean, no one here said, scrap the tamper-resistant capsule. No. All right. So tamper resistance. As we used to say in the ghetto, man, that don't even sound right. So what else have they got up their sleeve? What else have they got up their sleeve? Okay, so this doctor decided he was going to individually, on his own, implement his own solution, which was the Nancy Reagan Just Say No program. Let's see how that worked. That's another approach that doctors have. So let's take a look at this one. Now, this one has an unhappy ending, I have to warn you of. However, the approach and the activity is very representative of the approach and the way things are done. Okay, so on July 26, Dr. Graham had an appointment with the wife of a 48-year-old man who accompanied her. Now, the topic, let me give you the headline. Physician's murder highlights risks of saying no to opioids. Okay, so let's see if you can find the problem here. It was not the couple's first visit with Dr. Graham. They had been in his office about a month before with a wife seeking relief for chronic pain. Dr. Graham refused to prescribe opioid painkillers at that time, sparking a strong disagreement with the husband. The same scene played out again when Dr. Graham turned down the wife's request for opioid painkillers, explaining they were not appropriate for her chronic pain. She understood and didn't want them either. But the husband was insistent. The couple left only for the husband to return 2 hours later with a semi-automatic handgun. He intercepted Dr. Graham as he was driving to an adjacent rehab center and exchanged words with him. Jarvis followed Dr. Graham and shot him twice in the head in a parking lot after the physician stepped out of his vehicle. Jarvis then drove to a friend's house where he committed suicide. Okay. According to Carter, there's no evidence to suggest that Jarvis' wife was involved in her husband's murderous plan or knew about it. She's suffering too, he says in a news conference shortly after the shooting. Now, who is this Cotter character? Okay. By all accounts, when a physician denies a request for opioid painkillers, hostile responses usually come from the patient, not a relative. Either way, the response can be unnerving. Anybody who practices pain medicine has been threatened, says Dr. So-and-so, an anesthesiologist and pain specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. I've received notes saying I know where you live and that you have children. Okay, so let's stop right here. What what happened here? All right, we have a doctor. He has a practice setting. And in this practice setting, he prescribes narcotics. You, not you. Okay, so in other words, it is known that he is prescribing narcotics for somebody. That's why the people come to the office, right? Now, what could this doctor have done differently? Let me tell you what I did in my office. I had a blanket policy. I don't care who you are. I don't care what your name is. I don't got much money. I am not prescribing narcotics. I do not prescribe narcotics. And we even ask people when they make an appointment, are you anticipating a doctor might prescribe some narcotics for your pain? Oh, I'm sorry. The doctor does not do that. And so I simply have a blanket policy. And so people could not even show up at my office with the expectation that narcotics would be prescribed. That's number one. Number two, if someone was like not happy with that, I would just refund their money. Like, hey, here's your money. Don't worry about it. No narcotics here. So the problem was this doctor was put in a box that says, narcotics here. Someone comes with an expectation. He refuses to meet that expectation. That is what happened here. Let's see what their solution to this is. Sometimes anger is sparked when a physician ends someone's opioid therapy after discovering the patient is taking illicit drugs as well. Whoa. The physician ends someone's opioid therapy? That means he was prescribing it in the first place. I mean, like, no one mentions the possibility of let's not get started. Okay. So the doctor has created an addict in this example, second example they're giving, and then decides the addict, no more. Another potentially combustible situation arises when a longtime prescriber of opioid painkillers retires, and a younger replacement tries to wean patients off the drugs. The risk for belligerent behavior, threats, and violence reflects the demographics of patients in pain, according to Michna and others. Whoa, wait a minute. Blame the victim. The doctor creates this addict. You create a desperate person, and now you're going to say, well, people in pain are bad people prone to violence. No. Many people with doctor turned into addicts, and then decides he's going to cut off their supply and not be their pusher anymore, and they're still making their health insurance payments, and so in their mind, they're still paying. That can create some resentment, disappointment, you know? So close to 70% of pain patients have psychological comorbidities, like addictive behavior, he said. 70%. So again, what's skipped over here is that the doctor created the addict. Many have been in prison. They're desperate. And so this amounts to character assassination. I mean, how many of you have been in pain? Raise your hand. Everyone's been in pain at one point or another in their life. And so because of this, this makes you a belligerent person and violent. Nonsense. So to this doctor, the finding that 52% of pain management physicians have been threatened seems low. I would agree with that. In contrast, another doctor, president of the Academy of Integrated Pain Management, thinks the figure is too high, especially in light of her own experience. Dr. Katzman directs the University of New Mexico Pain Center in Albuquerque. Now, to her credit, she uses integrative pain management. So in my practice, absolutely no narcotics at all. However, I would recommend a glass of water. I would recommend an enema. There's a lot of things I'd recommend. Maybe an organic food diet. Maybe stop the alcohol, stop the cigarettes. A lot of recommendations. But no pain medicine. Why? It doesn't work. That's how people become addicts, because it does not work. And no one mentions it. Like, it's not even mentioned. So when you're using an ineffective therapy that's addictive and it literally ruins a person's life, the person might have some type of negative emotions. You know? Possible. Yeah. All right. She credits a peaceful atmosphere to patients knowing that her pain center does not prescribe opioids on the first visit, and that these drugs are far down in the list of possible treatments, which are interdisciplinary in nature. If all this is laid out from the beginning, there are not unmet expectations, Dr. Katzman said. Again, that's the big problem. So the young doctor taking over the practice of the older doctor who had prescribed opioids, the young doctor should immediately say, sorry, new rules. But wait, there's another issue, the safety valve. So in my practice, we had a safety valve. Anybody want narcotics? Guess what? They went to the pain clinic where they handed out narcotics like candy. I was even shocked. I was like, wow, that's amazing. But the clinic was run by the government. So the doctors at the clinic handing out narcotics like candy were pretty much immune to the same regulation or scrutiny as I was. And I knew this. And so I would tell people, you know what? You want narcotics? Go to the government pain clinic. You will get all the narcotics you want. And they went there, and they did. So that kept my practice very peaceful and easy. And so another doctor who's interviewed agrees with that approach, saying that it has lowered the level of conflict and anger at his hospital. Be upfront and mitigate false expectations, he says. Another key to averting blow-ups over opioids is curing communication with patients. For one thing, busy physicians need to stop looking at the clock and take time to explain why a patient is not a candidate for opioid therapy. But the length of the conversation is not enough. Now, this ignores the reality that many doctors are not self-employed. They don't have the discretion to take a half an hour with one patient. Listening, and then giving credible sense of caring when really all they're trying to do is get to the next patient and keep the paycheck flowing. So you have a doctor in an employee situation where the employer has set false expectations, then that employee slash doctor is in danger. And this is something I noticed early in my career as an employee. So as a doctor, you're an employee when you are working at a clinic, when you are an intern at a hospital. So the hospital's got all this signage, advertising campaign, and they have got these expectations that they have set for people who show up. And then, of course, here I am, little intern, and I have my instructions, which do not meet the expectations the advertising department set out. And this puts the employee in a very difficult position. Even if the employee is a fully licensed board certified doctor who may be collecting a substantial paycheck, you still have a situation where your employer has set the expectations beyond your control. And so what I did was I just stopped being an employee, and I had a situation where I could set the expectations. Like, hey, this is what I'm going to do, and then I do it. And so what are they advising these poor doctors? You need to build rapport with patients and win their trust. End it right there. The only reason the patient is coming to you is because of the advertising campaign put out by your employer or the advertising campaign put out by the insurance company. So it's pretty tough to build rapport when the patient is looking at you as a soda pop machine dispenser. That would be like expecting the person buying a soda pop to see the soda pop machine dispenser as something to create rapport with. So the patient is not even interested. They're not interested in creating rapport. What they want is, I came here to get something. I want what I came to get. It's like you go to a fast food joint. You don't spend, usually, a lot of time creating rapport with the clerk taking your order. You might want to smile. You might want to ask how her day is, but you really want your hamburger and you want it quickly. So to tell the doctor to build rapport with patients misses the whole reality of the situation, is that the patient isn't coming there for rapport. The patient is coming there for a narcotic prescription, or at least, they think, for relief of their pain. We have a commercial coming up, and we'll be back after the commercial.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Did you know that neither the American Medical Association nor the American Bar Association were established to benefit the American people? Have you recognized that in our country, health care has little to do with health, and that our court system has nothing to do with justice? The priests of both medicine and law have been incentivized to implement a dark agenda on behalf of the Bilderbergers and their ilk. To protect ourselves and our progeny, we need to take a much closer look at how these two giant industries really work. Join me, Al Whitney, on In Defense of Humanity, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Central, as we expose the matrix and learn how not to consent to our own destruction.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Hi, this is Dr. Daniels, and welcome back to Healing with Dr. Daniels. Alrighty, it is April 1st, 2018, and we are talking about the opioid epidemic and the numerous measures the medical industrial complex is taking, and of course, an update on, how's it going? Okay, so this Dr. Death, they're giving us more information on this. And so what's valuable with pain patients is motivational interviewing, in which the physician helps the patient in a non-confrontational way, don't confront them, to examine self-defeating behaviors and find the inner motivation to change them. You want patients to manage themselves, says Dr. Stanos. Well, wait a minute. Why are they coming to you if they're going to manage themselves? Yes. That alone might create some level of negativity and disappointment. You know, that whole approach. Okay. A pain management doctor can do all the right things, however, and still have a patient raise his or her voice, face reddening, hands waving. A bit of venting is tolerable, but at some point, a clinician may need to defuse the situation by bringing in another person. A behavioral health expert, say. Read more money. Into the discussion. And when he gets the behavioral health expert's check, or bill rather, talk about an explosion. Sometimes Dr. Stanos will leave the room momentarily to let the patient decompress and mull over what he said. And sometimes he announces that he will end the interview in so many minutes and offer to make a follow-up appointment. Of course, it may boil down to calling security or the police. Now, if a doctor is working in a setting where he has security, he's an employee. Because in a private doctor's office, generally, there's not the overhead. The overhead is too tight to allow for a full-time security officer. Threats of physical violence cannot be tolerated, says Dr. So-and-so. Even at the University of New Mexico Pain Center, where threats are rare, staff get periodic training on how to handle a volatile patient. And now this is why I stopped. I said I'm not even going to start prescribing narcotics. Because when I was in an employee situation, I literally saw grown women, 60-something, 70-something, have a meltdown in my office, like a 3-year-old tantrum, when I told them I was not prescribing narcotics. I said, huh, I can't believe this. And I'm like, I do not need to see adults acting in that kind of non-dignified, outrageous manner. And I decided that I would structure my medical practice so that it would bring out the best in people's behavior, and that I would have a good day, and they would have a good day. So it became pretty obvious to me that prescribing narcotics was not the way for me and my patients to have a good day. So I stopped. Now, so they're saying you should call security or the police. Now, security, if they're in the office or in the building, might show up in 3 minutes. The police, who knows, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, even if all you have is a fist fight, you could suffer a lot of harm. In other words, a doctor could suffer a lot of harm as a result of employing that strategy. So that doesn't make sense. And then you're going to call the police. The police are going to come to your office, maybe apprehend this patient, drag him out kicking and screaming. What effect is that going to have on everyone waiting in the waiting room? I mean, immediately it's going to flash through their mind, oh no, is that going to happen to me? So these are not reasonable solutions, but this is what they recommend. Call security. Call the police. All right. And so, of course, there's a packed funeral service. So if you're a doctor, and at least you should know that when your patient shoots you, there's going to be a good funeral service. So South Bend Orthopedics closes its doors on July 26th, shortly after the doctor's murder, and stayed closed the next day. The group practice shut down again the day of the funeral. Again, okay, so this is a group practice where the individual doctor was not the one making policy, so he wasn't free to make a policy in his own best interest and for his own personal survival. Hundreds of mourners, including many patients, filled St. Pius Catholic Church in Indiana and recalled how this doctrine is electric personality lit up a room like the sky on the 4th of July, and one of his three adult children, who was also an anesthesiology resident, said in a statement that he had planned to join his father as a physician in South Bend. I hope I can be the kind of doctor he can be proud of. Okay. But you don't want to be the kind of doctor he was, because you don't want to get shot. And so all my partners and I are nervous, he said. Will you hope that this doctor's murder is a once-in-a-lifetime incident? Yeah, it's a once-in-a-lifetime incident for him. You only get murdered once. Even so, just a few days after the shooting, a local emergency department doctor was threatened by a patient after he turned down a request for opioid pain medicine, according to the interviewed doctor. This time around, no harm came to the doctor, and the patient was arrested. Now, again, the setting is that doctors are no longer solo practice business owners. They are employees. And it is the policy set by the employer combined with limitations placed on the doctor employee that create this explosive situation. So you have an expectation set by the employer that cannot be met by the employee, and boom, an explosion. And so we're going to see, if you ask me, a lot more of these incidents. And we're getting a lot more nice, friendly, kind doctors meeting, as they say, a no good end. Now, of course, the FDA has not been idle. They've gotten in on the program. So what's the FDA got to say? Well, the FDA says all opioids are now subject to REMS. And so the Food and Drug Administration has said all opioids are subject to REMS, which is Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy Requirements. Yes. So what does that mean? This week, and this is September 29th, 2017, this week we issued letters notifying 74 manufacturers of opioid painkillers intended for use in the outpatient setting that their drugs will now be subject to a more stringent set of requirements under a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. This requires that training be made available to healthcare providers who prescribe opioids, including training on safe prescribing practices and consideration of non-opioid alternatives. Stop right there. Safe prescribing practices. There are no safe prescribing practices. It's an unsafe drug. The FDA has asked manufacturers to extend the training offer to pharmacists, nurses, and any providers involved in pain management. To offer training, manufacturers have provided unrestricted grants to accredited continuing education providers for courses that have content that has outlined that has been outlined by the FDA. So the FDA makes the requirement the manufacturer of the drugs that are causing the problems pay continuing medical education programs to teach this. And that's why a lot of continuing medical education programs are free for doctors, because they're actually bankrolled by drug companies. The blueprint of training content is being updated. That means it has not been updated. It is being updated to cover principles on acute, that means sudden, short-term, and chronic, that means long-term, pain management. Non-drug, opioid, and non-opioid drug pain therapies, information about the safe use of opioids, and basic information about addiction medicine and opioid use disorders. The FDA is also seeking public comment, how nice, on whether such training should be mandatory for prescribers. Interested parties have until December 29th to submit comments to the agency. So what the FDA is doing is they're creating an optional training program for doctors. So the training program is optional for doctors, but it's mandatory that the drug manufacturers have to finance and fund and provide this and make it available. So they have to make it available, but there's no assurance that doctors will ever see it or will ever consume it. And so the problem is, it talks about safe prescribing practices. There are no safe prescribing practices on narcotics. About the only safe thing you can say about a narcotic is tell the patient not to use it. Or if he uses it, to get off of it, or he's going to become a junkie. In other words, the same attitude that existed towards drugs really in the 60s and 70s. When I first came to medical school in 1979, the belief, certainly in the African American community, was that a drug was a drug was a drug, and the pharmaceutical drugs were no more desirable than the illegal drugs. And so anybody who was taking a pharmaceutical drug felt humiliated, ashamed, and to coin a popular term, less than. And this is an incredible stigma. And so what they don't want, though, is they don't want to put a stigma on these drugs, but they want the epidemic. I don't even know if they want the epidemic to go away. I think they want to appear that something is being done about this epidemic. One thing to understand is that under ERISA, that's the Employee Retirement Security Act, ERISA, the federal government is actually responsible for paying the pensions for many private companies. And so the government has an overriding interest in people dropping dead, shall we say, somewhere around the age, well, somewhere before the age of 65. And if you take a look at the black budget, in other words, the financing of the government operations with heroin, we'll call it opioid money, then you can see that the government really cannot afford for this heroin addiction, if you want to call it that, to stop. The other thing to look at is the average heroin addict gives somebody heroin, turn them into an addict at whatever age, doesn't matter. The general addict, your average addict, just wakes up one day at age 55, usually more or less, and says, you know what, I'm done. No more heroin for me, no more narcotics, I'm through. Doesn't interest me anymore. And so at that age, call it 55, your average addict is no longer useful to the government for financing the government, and they're not making their contribution. They're no longer backing the dollar. And if you look at that, then that coincides with the new peak in deaths in the 45 to 54 age group. Very, very interesting. So the death rate in the demographics affected actually fits very nicely into maximizing the economic profitability or benefit of the very industry, not only industry, entity called the government, that's charged with stemming the epidemic. So this is definitely a do-it-yourself situation, if you ask me. So I think what makes the most sense is to realize that the opioid epidemic is not it's not a problem. It's a solution. It's a solution to creating a strong dollar and the solution to minimizing retirement payouts. So it's not a problem. It is a solution. So once you understand that it's not a problem, that it's a solution, then that puts you in a better position to understand what you can do to make a difference. Let's say save yourself. First of all, if you're not using narcotics, very good, don't start. But I think it helps to understand what a narcotic is. And it's important to understand that many drugs are act as narcotics. In other words, they're addictive, they cause constipation, they depress respirations, they cause death. But the government has somehow decided not to classify them as narcotics. How about that? You like that, huh? One such drug is tramadol. Type that in the box here. And this is a very interesting drug used as a painkiller. And it was introduced in the 90s when I was in medical practice. And we doctors were told, this is not a narcotic. It is just as effective as narcotics, but don't worry, you can hand this out like candy. And so I must have prescribed this once or twice, and I said, no, we will not be doing this. And so once you realize this, you'd say, well, why would the FDA not classify an obvious narcotic as a narcotic? Answer: They're in on the scam. And what's the scam? The scam is to addict people and have their addiction finance the government, and also at the same time arrange it so they die at an age where they will not be able to collect retirement that they paid into. Now, the other thing about being an addict, so my medical practice are a lot of people, and I have family members, people in the community, a lot of people I know. And so back in the 90s, the big drug was cocaine. If you remember the Iran-Contra thing, the government was importing cocaine to help finance itself. All right. So the average cocaine addict, what were they doing? Who were these people? Okay, so the average cocaine addict that I was aware of, that I knew, was working two jobs, all the overtime they could get, holidays and weekends. I mean, the drug addicts were the hardest working, most productive people. And all they did was work, and use drugs. Work, and use drugs. So it turned a person of average productivity who might work one job, be frugal with their money, refuse to work holidays so they could spend it with their family, it turned that person into a working machine. Literally, this person got on the hamster wheel and pedaled as hard as he could to finance his habit. And so when you look at that, that's what an addict is. It's a person who's got two jobs, works overtime, weekends, and holidays. Then why wouldn't you want, or not you, but why wouldn't the government, who's collecting more, who finances itself with, one, the sale of the drugs, and two, taxes on the person's productivity, the perfect thing is a drug addict. The perfect thing is somebody who's hooked on cocaine or heroin or something. So you have to realize that this picture we see on the TV or the news or propaganda of these drug addicts as people laying around in alleys, that is not your typical addict. That may be the end point, but that is exactly what it is, the end point. And so that's something to realize, that these people are the backbone of the U.S. dollar, literally the backbone of the economy. And it turns out that, you know, you just don't need to work two jobs, holidays, weekends, and overtime to cover your basic needs. And your average individual, once you get up to like 50 hours a week, they're going to say, let me do without something. They might even turn off the electricity so that they can make ends meet. They're going to get resourceful and figure out some kind of way to cut their expenses to make ends meet. But an addict, no, because his big expense is not really something he's able to cut. So I think it helps to realize that there is no economic incentive for the government as we know it to in any way mitigate, lessen, or stem this epidemic. So don't look there for a solution. Also, I'd like to point out, I went to medical school 1979 to 83, and I went to University of Pennsylvania, which is a tertiary care hospital. It means they took care of the most difficult, complex cases. And it was located, of course, in a very poor inner-city area, predominantly African-American population. All right. 4 years of medical school. Only saw one overdose in the emergency department. And I was on call. I took an emergency room rotation. I mean, if there was an overdose, I would have either seen it or at least heard about it. So what's important to know about 1979 to 83? There was no war going on. The Vietnam War had ended in 75, and the various Gulf Wars had not yet started. There was no heroin on the streets. Amazing. So you have to realize that this stuff is, you know, being made available to you by your, you know, friendly government. So what are you going to do? Answer is avoid it, as you would any other as you would any other hazard. So you avoid it the way you would avoid a cliff or going over a waterfall that's 200 feet high. So you simply avoid it. So how do you avoid it? The answer is when you have pain, pain is not a reason to go to the doctor. Pain is something maybe you should handle on your own at home. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, Dr. Danz, what if the pain is more important? What if it's, I don't know, my appendix? Good question. Good question. So the medical industrial complex has done its own research and determined that at least in 66% of cases, surgery is not necessary for appendicitis. How about that? So even if it is your appendix, chances are outstanding that you don't need medical intervention, and the medical intervention is going to be totally unnecessary. So, how do you get rid of the pain, someone asks? The thing that people don't understand is most pain will go away by itself. So if you wake up in the morning with no pain and, terrible pain hits you, then most likely that pain will go away by itself. But let's talk about preventing that pain. What could you have done to prevent that pain? Usually, a couple more glasses of water. A lot of people get up in the morning, feel great, they're really excited, they got so much to do, and they just head out to do it without drinking a quart of water. That's that one little maneuver can do so much for people's pain. I've actually had people call me on the phone, frantic with pain. I say, okay, get a glass of water and first of all, rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10. Usually it's a 9 or a 10 is why they're calling. This is back in the old days when I was a doctor, but I was practicing. And I say, okay, fine. While we're on the phone, drink some water and tell me how you feel, and then we'll rate the pain again. The pain would go from a 9 to at least a 7 or 6. Just over a friggin' glass of water. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So that's an immediate maneuver. Glass of water, number one. Next maneuver is an enema. The enema, I would say, in about 25% of cases, pain gone, immediate curative, 25% of cases. In another 50% of cases, it tremendously lessens the pain. But in 25% of the cases, it does not help at all. So you need to be prepared for that, like, remote possibility. The other thing is the pain passes. Sometimes pain can last for 1, 3, 5 hours, and then it just passes. So that's another thing to be aware of. So the next thing is, okay, you've had your glass of water. Now what do you do? You've done your enema. Now what? The next thing is to take a look at everything that you were like, maybe you're going to eat that day, and maybe just stick to maybe raw vegetables to get through the day, or just water. We're going into a commercial time, so we're going to pick up after the commercial.
I saw you there, just standing there, and I thought I was only dreaming, yeah. I kissed you then, and then once again.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds, up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited. So take a breath, head to aroutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at aroutfitting.com.